All I would have here is one note of Miles, and no, that was him. That was it.
Many trumpet players who try to play like Clifford Brown, who try to play like Dizzy Gillespie, try to play like Satchmo, but nobody can play like Miles.
He was a master painter, maybe better than anybody.
Miles Dewey Davis painted with many colors over his nearly 50-year career. His trumpet style was instantly recognizable, even though his music was ever-changing. Miles was a restless spirit, always pushing himself and his music forward into uncharted terrain.
Miles followed his own bent from the get-go. And he went through a lot of changes, personal, musical, and every which way. And he had his way of going about his business, really, and nobody could tell him what not to do or what to do and all that.
Miles was by nature not a patient man. I think he got impatient with himself just as he did with other people. When he found something to play in a fresh way, in a new way, it would run its course, and then he would become bored with it, and he wanted something else. What's so amazing about him is that he always found that something else. Yet he remains himself.
Miles Davis dominated the world of jazz, changing the direction of the music, not just once, but several times. He was a lightning rod for other jazz musicians, teaming up with the brightest young players. And with them, he created some of the most influential music of the 20th century. I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of Jazz Profiles, Miles Stiles, a tribute to trumpeter Miles Davis. Miles Dewey Davis was born May 25, 1926, in Alton, Illinois. He began playing the trumpet as a youngster in East St. Louis, Illinois. Early on, his playing showed promise. In 1943, when he was just 17 years old, he approached bandleader Eddie Randall for advice and got his first real gig.
When I heard the first note, he had a job then, because he had a beautiful sound. The first jam session that Miles was in, we were playing at a place called the Club Rumboogie. Boy, what was coming out of that horn was something beautiful he was playing.
Just a year later, the Billy Eckstine Big Band came to nearby St. Louis, Missouri, and the young Miles Davis was invited to sit in. In that band were alto saxophonist Charlie Parker and trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie. Miles idolized these young pioneers of a new form of jazz called bebop. he was determined to follow them to New York City. Miles was accepted to New York's prestigious Juilliard School of Music, and it was just the excuse he needed. But he never really made it to the classroom. He spent his time on 52nd Street, ground zero for the bebop revolution, listening to Diz and Bird. Charlie Parker played like a speed demon, beyond the technical abilities of Miles at that time. Still, when Dizzy Gillespie vacated the trumpet chair in Parker's band, Miles jumped at the offer to replace him. Writer Ashley Kahn.
For a very headstrong young trumpet player to come from St. Louis to find his heroes and within a year to drop out of Juilliard and find himself within the band of Charlie Parker, it was like he had died and gone to heaven. But at the same time, each night when he was on stage trying to keep up with Bird, it was like he had gone right back down to hell.
Trumpeter John Faddis.
At that time, the music had evolved to a very complicated music. I think at the beginning it was very difficult for Miles to keep up with Charlie Parker. I think Miles' sense of space and time developed because of his apprenticeship that he spent with Dizzy and Charlie Parker.
Miles Davis first recorded with Charlie Parker in 1945. Compared to Parker, Miles' playing was tentative, careful, often just filling harmonies behind the powerful alto saxophonist.
Miles was more relaxed.
French jazz producer Frank Tenno.
I remember some people in France, you see, in 46, who was a little upset by the bebop. I think the way of Miles Davis was not so shocking. Parker was a little rough. You have to follow him. It's not very easy. French people love Johnny Hodges, you see. They love Coleman Hawkins. And when they hear Charlie Parker, you have to change your mind, you see, and to have a new view. But Miles was the go-between. Huh? He was so cool, quiet.
The sheer velocity of Parker's technique made Miles Davis take another tack and continue with a more measured, introspective approach. Following his stint with Charlie Parker, Miles began to lead his own groups around New York. At the same time, he and arranger Gil Evans tinkered with a very different sound from the bebop of the day. They organized a 9-piece band, which featured an unusual combination of instruments, including a baritone saxophone, a French horn, and a tuba. This nonet went into the studio in January 1949. The arrangements were by band members Gil Evans, Jerry Mulligan, and John Lewis. Their music would come to be known as The Birth of the Cool. Writer Ashley Kahn.
Gil Evans, he described it as hanging like a cloud. The sound would hang like a cloud. And that was really where The Birth of the Cool got its sound. Miles then starts to find a much more late-night, melancholy approach to expressing himself on the trumpet. It was definitely in response to the fury and the fire and the passion that was all about what bebop was about.
Trumpeter John Faddis.
Birth of the Cool. That was a different type of ensemble sound, and that was a very different type of phrasing. I think his sense of space developed out of that. In jazz, personality is so important. He didn't want to sound like anybody else.
And Miles didn't sound like anybody else.
When Miles found his own sound It was right there in the middle register of the trumpet. It did not have the type of high register flurries that Dizzy had, but that was where Miles's sound was. And that tied right in with The Birth of the Cool.
The Nonette fell apart for lack of work, but this new sound found its way to the West Coast, carried on by saxophonist Jerry Mulligan, trumpeter Chet Baker, and others. It was the seed of what would later be known as cool jazz. Boplicity, performed by the Miles Davis Nonette. I'm Nancy Wilson. You're listening to Miles Stiles, a tribute to the many musical sides of trumpeter Miles Davis on NPR's Jazz Profiles. Miles Davis may have been a major force in spearheading the cool jazz movement, but his foundation was still rooted firmly in bebop. In 1951, he began recording a series of records for the Prestige label and hired some of the most talented beboppers of the day. Pianist Thelonious Monk, vibraphonist Milt Jackson, trombonist J.J. Johnson, and here on a 1951 session, a budding tenor saxophonist named Sonny Rollins. Sonny Rollins would be the first in a long line of world-class saxophonists to be associated with Miles Davis.
Everybody loved Sonny, especially the way he was playing back then, really. He was the most valuable saxophonist you could have, really. For example, Thelonious told me that that was the one that he liked the best. And I know that Miles loved Sonny too, and he was trying out very many things, and everybody wanted him.
Soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy followed Miles in the early 1950s.
Miles was a young disciple of Charlie Parker's, and it's logical that he developed a strong relationship even with the instrument. Trumpet and sax is a smooth partnership, really. You know, if you get the right guys, you can really make dynamite out of that.
Working on his trumpet sound, Miles Davis discovered that a mute gave it an otherworldly character. It soon became a Miles trademark. Dan Morgenstern is the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University.
He played mostly open horn up to a certain point in time when he discovered the Harmon mute. Now, the Harmon mute, usually when you play ballads, most trumpet players would use a cup rather than a Harmon. But Miles, always different, Miles picked a Harmon. So this was just another indication of Miles's originality and inventiveness. And once he started doing that, of course, it appealed especially to the ladies. Hearing Miles at an intimate setting when he would start playing a ballad with that mute, all the ladies would swoon. The guys liked it too. Mm-hmm.
Richard Rodgers and Lorenz Hart's My Funny Valentine, performed by Miles Davis and his All-Stars. In the early 1950s, Miles Davis was building his repertoire as well as expanding his sound. He put the Miles touch to popular songs like My Funny Valentine and Surrey with a Fringe on Top, helping to make these and other tunes jazz standards. And he was composing his own material. Miles was also experimenting with personnel, mixing bebop veterans with young lions in loose, improvised recording sessions. Pianist Horace Silver had just arrived in New York.
The group was Miles and Lucky Thompson. It was just a quintet. Percy Heath on bass and Kenny Clark on drums and myself. We didn't rehearse. We just went into the studio, ran the arrangements down, and tried to cut them. It wasn't coming off right. Not that there was anything wrong with the arrangements, but I don't know, it just wasn't gelling right, and Miles wasn't satisfied with what was going on. And he said, well, look, put the music aside. We're going to just jam something, you know. And shoot, we did Walking. I think we did one take on that, and that was the session. It just went by, bam, like that, you know, and it was cooking.
Silver recalls that even in his earliest years, Miles had command in the studio.
He had that knack of just putting something together at the last minute, and it would come out sounding great. He's reached over my shoulder and showed me the voicings he wanted me to play behind him. I think what he was trying to express to the guys was he wanted them to take some chances, you know, not to just play what you practice at home and play some cliches. I mean, everybody plays cliches from time to time. When you get hung up for an idea, you put a stick in a cliche, you know. I think what Miles was saying was to take some chances. Okay, if you make a mistake, go ahead, you know, but we want to stretch out and make the music exciting, you know, so don't just play it safe all the time.
Miles Davis's reputation as one of jazz music's top band leaders and experimenters was growing all the time. But he was sidelined for a time with mounting drug and personal problems. In the summer of 1955, Miles made a strong comeback at the Newport Jazz Festival. His playing impressed Columbia Records so much that they signed him as a major solo artist. But Columbia insisted he have a solid touring band. So Miles, with his ear for talent, handpicked a group of virtually unknown players. Bassist Paul Chambers was just 20 years old. Pianist Red Garland had a hard-driving swing, and like Miles, he was a boxer. Steve Lacy.
One thing about Miles is very important, I think, is the boxing rhythms, the sparring and the jabbing. That's an important source of a rhythm. The drummer, the relationship with the drummer was extremely important. He always had great drummers, and I mean, that's part of the secret. Of course, Philly Joe Jones was the one.
Drummer Philly Joe Jones was prized among the inner circle of jazz musicians, but was nearly unknown to the public. The same was true of saxophonist John Coltrane at that time. He had played with R&B groups and Dizzy Gillespie's big band, but he was yet to establish his name. Dan Morgenstern.
When Coltrane came on board, Coltrane was not initially well received, especially by the critics. They didn't like Coltrane, they didn't like his sound, and it took them quite a while to catch on. But the public caught on, the records were selling, and what was wonderful about that band, the whole group was so well balanced.
Miles' well-balanced quintet recorded their debut album for Columbia, in 1955, round about midnight. It was an immediate success, and Miles was headed for stardom. In 1957, Miles reunited with arranger Gil Evans, his collaborator on The Birth of the Cool some 8 years earlier. They built on that foundation of a lean and open sound with Miles' second album for Columbia, Miles Ahead. For the first time, Miles fronted a big band with Gil Evans as conductor. Saxophonist Steve Lacy.
It's just made in heaven. You see, Gil had perfect taste, absolutely impeccable. He had a fantastic ear. That was two geniuses working together. They were brothers, really. They were artistic lovers, really, collaborators. And they had an enormous respect for each other, and they were on the same wavelength.
Blues for Pablo, a tribute to painter Pablo Picasso. A year later, Gil Evans and Miles Davis would go back into the studio to tackle George Gershwin's opera, Porgy and Bess.
Some people may not agree, but it may be the pinnacle of the Miles Davis-Gil Evans collaborations.
Jazz historian Dan Morgenstern.
Porgy and Bess is an absolute masterpiece. Miles and Gil found a fresh way to look at something that had been done so many times, and that's summertime. There's that little figure. You know, that little repeating figure that Gil invents for a backdrop for Miles. It's like you're hearing Summertime for the first time.
With tunes like Summertime, Miles' lean, moody sound was now easily identifiable, and not just with jazz insiders. Columbia Records promoted Miles with the same intensity it promoted its biggest pop stars, like Johnny Mathis or Doris Day. But much of Miles' greatest work was still ahead, miles ahead. And he would face numerous personal challenges that would take him away from his music. That and more is just ahead. I'm Nancy Wilson. You're listening to Miles Stiles, a tribute to trumpeter Miles Davis on Jazz Profiles from NPR, National Public Radio. Since his start in the mid-1940s, trumpeter Miles Davis had made several stylistic changes. He honed his craft with bebop's virtuosos, and he helped initiate the lean sound of cool jazz. He developed a hard-driving quintet, and he thrilled listeners with his intricate collaborations with arranger Gil Evans. In a little more than a decade, Miles had become an international star. Miles had one of the tightest bands around by the late 1950s, but always competitive and constantly searching to expand his sound, he added another voice to his already successful quintet. Alto saxophonist Cannonball Adderley was a rising star in the jazz world. Dan Morgenstern is the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University.
When Miles added Cannonball to the quintet, that took a lot of us by surprise because it was such a perfectly balanced quintet. I think what Miles was looking for was contrast. Cannonball had an affirmative, happy kind of sound and feeling to his music. And that contrasted with Coltrane's moodiness. So it was a matter of another sound. When you have three horns, of course, you can do more things.
In the spring of 1958, Miles recorded Milestones with his new band. With trumpet, alto, and tenor up front, the band became a pressure cooker of creative energy and new musical ideas, with Miles as head chef. Cannonball Adderley, from a radio interview in the early 1960s.
The band was a workshop. Miles really kind of talked to everybody and told everybody what to not do. Hey, don't do that. Well, he never told anybody what to play.
Milestones marked the beginning of Miles Davis's experimentation with modal music. Musicians would play against a single mode or scale instead of with chord changes, the usual harmonic foundation in jazz. With this new, simpler basis for improvisation, the music began to change. Miles, written by Miles Davis, from the album Milestones. Since its earliest years, Miles had been crafting a subdued, introspective kind of music. So it was no surprise that he liked the classically influenced approach of Bill Evans, a young pianist on the scene. His style offered something different from the hard swing of Red Garland, Miles' current pianist. Cannonball Adderley.
Miles said to me, "Cannon, I'd like for you to take a ride with me." I said, "Okay," which is dangerous. We were driving up the West Side Highway. He had a little Mercedes 190 SL. He said, "Man, have you ever heard Bill Evans?" I'd heard him and I enjoyed him. So Miles asked me, "What did I think of him?" I said, "Man, I think he's beautiful." And he said, "Good." And we had so much fun with what we could do with him. Miles just told Red, "Say, hey, man, I'm going to keep Bill." And that's how Bill got in the band.
Jimmy Cobb had taken over the drum chair, and with pianist Bill Evans in place, Miles Davis made his landmark 1959 recording, Kind of Blue. Picking up where the record Milestones left off, Kind of Blue sharpened Miles' experiments with modal jazz. With Evans, he challenged his musicians to improvise on single modes instead of fast-moving chords. This approach gave them newfound freedom. Bill Evans in a 1979 radio interview.
It was a very simple thing that he came in with conceptually. All of it was more or less created out of the musicians themselves. Miles had that ability to create a kind of a simple figure, like on So What, that still generates a complete and positive reference off of which you can play and still relate to something which is unique.
So What, from Miles Davis's album, Kind of Blue. This simple, unrehearsed, two-day studio session became some of the most enduring music of the 20th century. Kind of Blue was a high-water mark for Miles Davis, but his sidemen had reached leader status in their own right. And it would have been impossible for anyone, even Miles Davis, to keep that group together. Bill Evans, John Coltrane, and Cannonball Adderley formed their own bands, and once again, Miles Davis faced the challenge of creating a new ensemble. As before, he depended on his instinct for finding the most talented musicians around, players who would take his music to another level.
I played with Miles Davis from 1963 until 1968.
Pianist Herbie Hancock.
When I first started playing with Miles, Tony Williams, he and I were the newest members of the band. Ron Carter was playing bass.
With his rhythm section in place, Miles auditioned a parade of tenor saxophonists, settling on George Coleman for a time. That band, began to explore the outer edges of harmony and rhythm. Miles was intrigued.
Well, one day Miles said to us, "Why don't you play behind me the way you play behind George?" And I looked at Tony like, is he serious? You know? And so we said, okay. The next time Miles came up with solo, we let him have it. We start playing all kinds of different things that we normally didn't play behind him. His, you know, body would jerk from side to side, trying to find a place in, make some sense and some music out of the things that we were doing. But he was obviously having a difficult time. The next day, he wanted more. And the third day, I was the one twisting and turning and trying to find my place, because Miles had not only grabbed the ball, but he ran with it. All of a sudden, the whole thing opened up to even more possibilities for him. And then I had to find a whole new way of playing behind Miles. At the end of that day, Miles said, I don't want to play any chords anymore.
Things changed again with the arrival of a young tenor player from Newark, New Jersey.
I walked in the dressing room. Miles said, "You know my stuff." I said, "Yeah." "Uh-oh." He said, "You must be bad."
By 1964, the final member of the classic Miles Davis Quintet of the 60s was on board. George Coleman was gone, and in his place was Wayne Shorter.
We walked out on the stage. I thought he was going to play, and he stepped away. "You got it."
Right away, Miles discovered that Wayne Shorter took his group to a very different place.
Miles came over and said, "You got any music?" And I had my book with me. I had a lot of tunes. I said, "Yeah." The first thing he looked at was ESP.
"Let's do this."
Wayne came up with that wonderful material for that band. It went to a different place than the quintet with Coltrane. It was a different kind of feeling, and it was tremendously influential. They really seemed to have extrasensory perception.
Jazz historian Dan Morgenstern.
I have never, I think, seen or heard a band where they were more attuned to each other. It was just amazing what they could do.
ESP was the first recording for the new Miles Davis Quintet. In the studio, there was a commitment to breaking new ground. Miles leaned on the creative instincts and compositional talents of Wayne Shorter, and the result was pure inspiration. With his powerful new quintet, Miles Davis reached a new level of intuitive ensemble playing. It was a new golden period in the career of Miles Davis. I'm Nancy Wilson. You're listening to Miles Styles, a look at the many musical styles of Miles Davis on NPR's Jazz Profiles. In the late 60s, Miles felt the power of the rock revolution around him, and he liked what he heard. Miles began incorporating electric instruments into his band. In 1967, he invited guitarist George Benson to join the Miles Davis Quintet on the album Miles in the Sky. The driving rhythms of funk music also began to find their way into Miles' music. James Brown and Sly Stone were particularly influential on Miles. Eventually, Miles' expanding musical ideas could not be contained with a quintet. He needed a larger palette to work with, and he was determined to find the most promising musicians around to bring his conceptions to life. The 1969 recording, In a Silent Way, featured a three-keyboard ensemble, Herbie Hancock, Chick Corea, and Joe Zawinul, with guitarist John McLaughlin. Miles was now electric, and this recording returned Miles to the charts for the first time in 4 years. That same year, Miles Davis recorded Bitches Brew. It became a hallmark for the jazz fusion movement that followed in the 70s. Bitches Brew was a shocking turn with its marriage of jazz, rock, and funk. But the double album was wildly successful. Dan Morgenstern was the editor of Downbeat magazine at that time.
The advent of Bitches Brew was something of a monumental change. Everybody was used to Miles coming from another direction. He was a master at that, and you know, his whole history up to then had been one of changeability. But Bitches Brew was very radical, and it came at a time when rock and roll was really making severe inroads into jazz, and the recording industry was on the verge of forgetting that there was such a thing as jazz. Miles's Bitches Brew came as a shock to some people. I mean, there were some people who insisted that, oh, this isn't jazz. It was a major splash.
The aftershock of Bitches Brew marked the most controversial period in Miles Davis's career. He had seemingly left all of his past music and that audience behind. Despite fathering an entire genre of music, jazz fusion, Miles Davis dropped out of the music scene in 1974. He had various health issues and fatigue, and Miles did not record or perform live again until the early 1980s. By 1981, there was a new musical landscape. The jazz fusion movement had peaked and was in decline. Miles had regained his health, composed some new music, and he re-emerged to a hero's welcome. Soprano saxophonist and Miles watcher, Steve Lacy.
He was a star. See, not everybody is a star. There's a lot of great musicians, they're not stars. But that star thing is another deal. It's a different game, the star game. And Miles played it to the hilt, really. He loved it, you know?
As with his hard bop years of the 1950s, Miles bravely chose to reinterpret the popular music of the day. Hits like Cyndi Lauper's Time After Time. Michael Jackson's Human Nature. Miles also toyed with reggae and rap music. He toured the world and recorded a parade of albums. We Want Miles, Star People, Decoy, and You're Under Arrest all made the charts. His album, Tutu, was dedicated to South African Bishop Desmond Tutu. It won a Grammy. Saxophonist Steve Lacy.
He went through a lot of changes, personal, musical, and every which way. And he had his way of going about his business, really. And he tried everything. He had appetite. You know, he had elan. He had all the qualities, so why shouldn't he indulge in all the different things, the vices, and then later on the virtues? That's an artist. All you could do is follow along and appreciate it.
And if you did follow along with Miles Davis's career, you would have heard many different styles, from bebop to cool, from hard bop to modal, to fusion and beyond. But at the core was the same brilliant artist.
There is a very strong personality there that runs throughout the different styles of Miles. It's always him.
Dan Morgenstern.
He always challenges himself. By setting himself those challenges, he wins each time. He comes to a new plateau.
Miles Davis died September 28, 1991, in Santa Monica, California. Throughout his career, he set the pace for modern jazz. Miles stretched the boundaries of musical expression and was forever on the lookout for like-minded musicians. With them, he created an array of adventurous sounds and styles, all of them distinctively Miles. And by fostering the highest musical development of his players, he created his rightful place, alongside Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and others, as one of the most important figures ever to be involved in jazz. He was a true original. Miles Styles, our tribute to trumpeter Miles Davis, was written and produced by Jim Luce. Technical director, Duke Marcos. Program consultant, Ashley Kahn. The executive producer for Jazz Profiles is Tim Owens. Senior producer, Margaret Howes. Assistant producer, Madeline Smith. Administrative assistant, Linda Browen. Website coordinator, John Murph. We'd like to thank the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. Also, Eugene Holly, Bob Campbell, Mark Faulkner, Phil Schapp, Murray Horwitz, NPR's Wynton Marsalis Making the Music, Sony Music, Fantasy Records, WKCR New York, and WBGO Newark. To email us or for more information about this program and others in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Or check us out at nprjazz.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, seeking to enrich community life through support of education, arts, and culture. Additional support has been provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson. This is NPR, where jazz lives.
Thanks for listening. To hear more programs in this series, go to npr.org/jazzprofiles.